Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Mokhtar Awad, a research associate with the National Security and International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress.
In this episode, we talked about the development of jihadism in the Sinai prior to the Egyptian uprising in January 2011, what jihadi individuals and movements were up to between the uprising and the coup in July 2013, a deep dive on Jamaat Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, or ABM, how ABM has changed since it became Wilayat Sinai of the Islamic State, the role of IS's provinces in Libya in the western desert of Egypt, and background on the ABM splinter faction Al-Murabitun that is pro-AQ and led by Hisham Ashmawi that pledged bayat to Ayman al-Zawahiri.
After the interview, we're going to have a new hashtag social media segment covering postings from October 14th through the 23rd. And I also want to mention that if you're a fan of the show, you can sign up to help support the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes. And over the next couple days, Aaron and I are going to start putting out some of the bonus content that will only be available to supporters on Patreon. But first, before the interview, we have an updated primary sources section, which will be covering releases from September 20th through October 14th. And to start off this episode's primary sources segment, Aaron, why don't you tell us about the videos that the Islamic State has been releasing in the beginning of October?
So one of the themes that they've been putting out, as you might recall, in the last podcast, you know, they put out a series of a bunch of different videos about a similar topic. And between October 1st and 14th, we saw 8 videos related to Somalia and the Islamic State calling on individuals to pledge bayah. And it's quite auspicious that this podcast is talking about this, since the day that we're recording it now on October 23rd, we just heard of an actual pledge of bayah from Shabab leader Sheikh Abdul Qadir Mu'min pledging bayah with a group of others in northern Somalia. So it shows that there is clearly something being staged to bring this about in the Islamic State's sort of media campaign. But in terms of the specific videos itself, we saw one coming from the Sinai province on October 1st, where it was urging the Mujahideen in Somalia to join the ranks and join the consensus by allying with the Islamic State and pledging allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and urging the Mujahideen in Somalia not to struggle or fight against them. Similarly, on the 1st from Wilayat Homs in Syria, they say that they should leave infighting and join in the fight against the global regime and the extension of the Crusader campaign. Again on the 1st, but in Wilayat Nineveh this time in Iraq, the Islamic State's asking those in Somalia what they're waiting for and why they do not join the jihad under the caliphate. And then other individuals in this video are discussing the Crusader campaign against Somalis in cooperation with the Christians of Africa, and therefore trying to, you know, make a parallel to what they're fighting in Iraq and Syria. A day later on the 2nd in Wilayat al-Raqqa, the video features IS fighters of Somali origin addressing their countrymen in Somali and praising life in the Islamic State and the camaraderie amongst the Mujahideen. And pains them to see their brothers missing out on the joys of life in the caliphate, and saying that they only want the best for them. Also on the 2nd, this time in Wilayat Hadramaut in Yemen, this video seems to be particularly targeted to foreign fighters within Somalia and urging them to share the joy of fighting for the caliphate. This is relevant in terms of the fact that there have been a number of stories that some foreign fighters within Somalia in the past month or two have been trying to build up support for IS, but through Shabab's security apparatus, they've liquidated them since they found out about these plans, and highlighting that a lot of the support, while there are definitely some Somalis that support IS in Somalia, many of them are actually the foreign fighters that remain there. Also on the 2nd, we have one from Wilayat al-Furat, the province that goes on the Syrian and Iraqi sides of the border. and they're highlighting the joys of life under the caliphate and the need for unity amongst the mujahideen. Then a day later, on October 3rd, we light Al-Khair, or the Deir ez-Zor province in Syria, discusses Christian violence against Muslims and addressing the Somali fighters and their compatriots, praising the Islamic State and urging the Somali mujahideen to join their brothers. And then about 11 days later, we have a late video in this series, and it's the last one, and it's coming from Wilayat Gharbi Frikiya in Nigeria, possibly highlighting sort of the delays in the media operations with the Nigerian province, and we've seen that in some ways with other releases as well. But they're talking in the local language in Hausa. Talking about pledging bay'ah will strengthen the mujahideen and weaken the unbelievers, and that unity of Muslims is more important than nationalism or self-interest, potentially a slight at al-Shabaab since they focus so much on Somalia, not necessarily a broader agenda, even though Shabaab itself has obviously done attacks in Kenya, Ethiopia, and Uganda.
And what about Islamic State videos released during that time that aren't dealing with Somalia?
So there was one other interesting one we came across on October 3rd, where the Islamic State's Wilayat Dimashq put out a video about them imposing the Dhimma contract upon Christians in the village of Al-Kiratain. Within it, they're highlighting how they took the Christians of the town captive and offered them a choice between death or accepting the jizya arrangement and living under the Islamic State. Of course, individuals agreed to this. And one of the IS fighters in the videos then addresses Christians worldwide, stating that they'll have to pay the jizya and citing Quranic injunctions to Christians, highlighting that this is an example that will be repeated once more. And falls in line with their sort of narrative related to how they'll eventually conquer Rome. And after that, of course, I guess the White House too.
And what about videos from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula during this time period?
We saw one interesting one on October 1st from Sheikh Khalid bin Umar Batarfi discussing the issue of mosque bombings and Al-Qaeda's longstanding opposition to attacking mosques and Muslims. And highlighting the sanctity of mosques and the prohibition on attacking them. And then Batarfi condemns the actions of the Houthis in Yemen for allegedly attacking mosques. Interestingly enough, as far as I saw, he didn't mention anything related to the Islamic State, who has also been attacking mosques in Yemen as well, though they have been about for the Houthis and the Zaydi Shia. So it's interesting that they don't mention it, since in this particular video, they mention how it's forbidden even to target Shia mosques in Pakistan, for example.
And Jabhat al-Nusra has put out several videos from early through mid-October. Can you tell us what those contained?
So on October 5th, Jabhat al-Nusra interviewed a bunch of people in their territory and asking average Muslims what their opinion was of the Russian intervention in the aftermath of it. And people were describing it as a war on Islam, and in particular on Sunnis, and that it was nothing but support for the Assad regime in cooperation with the Iranians. And many of them were comparing the situation to the repulsion of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, alluding to things that we might see going forward. 5 days later, on October 10th, Jabhat al-Nusra put out a video related to a lot of the infighting that has been going on within the Syrian context, and a voiceover of an individual recounts how the early jihad in Syria was characterized by unity of purpose against the Alawite regime, and that the announcement of the caliphate by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi came as a sharp slap to Muslims, and that IS began to consolidate their power by spreading rumors and stealing from the mujahideen. And then they provide a bunch of examples of crimes by IS. Then it interviews some Jabhat al-Nusra fighters that are discussing the need for unity and attributing their victories in Idlib to cooperation and coordination between factions. And the video concludes by condemning Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's divisive tactics that have led only to defeat and disunity. And the final video from Jabhat al-Nusra in this period, or I should say audio message, was on October 12th from Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, the leader of JN, discussing the Russian intervention and highlighting from his own view that the Russians have decided to intervene to bolster the regional influence against the West, to strengthen their hand in Ukraine, and that the Russian intervention can only be considered a sign of the failure of Iran and Hezbollah, and that the regime is itself on its last legs and becoming extremely desperate. And he refutes Russia's claims that they are targeting IS, saying that the strikes are actually hitting Jaish al-Fatah, which, if you recall, is a coalition of a bunch of groups, including Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and other smaller factions, and blames a Shia conspiracy with the so-called Eastern Crusaders, highlighting, I guess, the difference between the different crusades that are allegedly going on against them, with the Western countries. Though, I guess, in some ways, you could argue that the Russian case is probably more valid, since a lot of the Russian propaganda and messaging from the Russian Orthodox Church in Moscow and the Kremlin has talked about an actual holy war, where if you looked at any messaging from any Western leader or individual of influence, there's nothing related to this at all. It's more geopolitics and geostrategy. So that's what we got from Jabhat al-Nusra during that time period.
And similar to last week, we're going to highlight any other videos or releases from notable jihadi ideologues. Can you tell us what you've come across that you think is interesting and worth noting here?
Yeah, on October 4th, we had a new essay put out by Sheikh Abu al-Mundar al-Shinkiti, talking about a theme similar to what AQIP was actually talking about, related to warning the Mujahideen about bombing mosques. Though this is more in relation to IS than anything specific to Yemen or the Houthis. And he was outlining the importance and sanctity of mosques, and saying that nowadays certain Mujahideen have forgotten themselves in jihad and have committed violations against mosques and their worshippers that go even beyond the crimes of the tyrants and their soldiers. And those who think that attacking mosques constitutes a form of jihad are mistaken and have forgotten important parts of Islamic teachings, and saying that attacks on mosques are attacks on Islam itself, and those who attack mosques are not following the example of the Muslim prophet Muhammad and his companions, and rather they're following the example of the enemies of God. And he provides the example of Baruch Goldstein, the Jewish extremist in Israel, who killed 29 Palestinians in Hebron in 1994 when he shot up a mosque there.
And during this end of September, beginning of October timeframe, what have we seen released from Al-Qaeda?
So if you recall, in the last podcast, we talked a little bit about Ayman al-Zawahiri starting this new video series calling the Islamic Spring. And in that one, we talked about the first two videos. In this one, we're going to be talking about the one since then, 3 through 6. In the third one, Ayman al-Zawahiri proposes a discussion about the concept of the caliphate on the model of Muhammad, as opposed to the caliphate of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, which he regards as illegitimate. And he discusses five different things related to it: the definition of the prophetic caliphate, a description of its key characteristics, the correct Sharia procedures for choosing a caliph, and most important attributes of a caliph, and finally responding to some suspicions. In the fourth video of this series, he goes further, answering questions that have been posed, such as, if a caliph takes power by force, is it incumbent upon us to obey him? Is it any caliphate better than none at all? What will be the consequences of not pledging bay'ah, given the famous hadith that says, quote, he who does not pledge bay'ah will die in ignorance, end quote. And Zawahiri responds by saying, it must be based on consultation, not imposition, that the caliphate is divisive and weakens the Mujahideen, and so on. And he gives examples of when the companions refused to pledge bay'ah to caliphs they considered illegitimate. In the fifth video, Zawahiri continues the discussion related to the caliphate and whether conditions are right at the moment for the establishment of a caliphate, and if not, what the alternative is to the establishment of a caliphate. And he answers the first question by saying that a caliphate has to be established with the will of the Muslim nation, otherwise it's not legitimate. And regarding the second question, he sees Al-Qaeda is a legitimate alternative, and highlighting that they'll not declare takfir or apostasy on Muslims or blow up mosques and other examples like that. And then in the final video in this series, at least that have been released thus far, it's possible that maybe he'll release more, but we haven't seen anything yet. He discusses a different issue, not necessarily specific to the caliphate question, but the so-called Safavid Iranian threat that is working in cooperation with the Crusader campaign against the Sunni Muslim nation, as Zawahiri argues. And he's saying how the Iranians are helping to sow discord between the Mujahideen and dividing them into factions, and highlighting the Iranian threat in Yemen via the Houthis, and criticizing the Gulf regime's illegitimate and unable to defend the Gulf against the Safavids and what they're trying to do there. And the final release from Al-Qaeda during this period that was interesting was on October 9th, when they released the second issue of the Al-Nafir magazine online. And in it, it critiques the outcome of the Arab Spring, pointing to the failure of the revolutions to bring about Islamic rule. And in it, it states that only Dawah and Jihad can achieve this goal, and that they should learn from the mistakes of others and not follow a man who demands bayah while breaking the bayah he himself swore, an allusion to the alleged bayah that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi gave to bin Laden when he first came into power in the Islamic State of Iraq in 2010, and then later Zawahiri when he took over from bin Laden. And this issue of Al-Nafir concludes urging all Muslims to unite, reiterating AQ's allegiance to the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan or the Taliban, and the establishment of a righteous caliphate based upon consultation.
And during this time period, we've had two videos released from Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna. Can you tell us what those videos covered?
Yeah, definitely. On September 20th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna put out a video related to the opening of a hospital, and that it was a hospital sort of given in the name of the different martyrs. And they're showing footage of the opening ceremony and hoping that it would provide better health care to those locally. And one of the points that they make in the video is that IS attacked and damaged the previous hospital, and therefore they're reestablishing it, and how the Majlis are taking steps to provide health care for the people of Darna. A couple of weeks later, on October 12th, they put out another video, this time a testimony from the director of what they call the state organization's court in Darna, an allusion to the Islamic State. And his director was a man named Abu Umar al-Shankiti, suggesting he's probably Mauritanian. And he decided to speak out because of IS's practices of takfir. And he said that at first he was excited by the idea of the caliphate, but became disillusioned and disappointed in other members who he considered hypocrites, and accused the Islamic State of stealing money from banks, not providing public services and essential supplies, killing people for no good reason, and turning a blind eye to drug dealing.
And can you tell us about the video that Jaish al-Fatah released towards the end of September?
So on September 23rd, Jaish al-Fatah put out a video discussing the formation of the Judicial Council in areas controlled by it, and highlighting how the council had several offices, including one for research and one for public relations, and then describing the structure of the court, including courts for personal circumstances and a court for reconciliation and arbitration. But also highlighting one that they deemed important in the video related to detention and making sure that no one is detained arbitrarily.
And finally, can you tell us about the brief statement the Taliban released towards the end of September?
So on September 28th, the Taliban, or the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, after the fall of Kunduz, put out a statement from its Commission for Control and Administration of NGOs and Companies, encouraging all employees of NGOs, private companies, and telecoms to continue their work normally and to contact the commission if they have any complaints on contact numbers provided.
All right, and now here's Aaron's conversation with Mokhtar Awad.
Although Egypt in many ways is viewed as the birthplace of modern jihadism with the ideas of Said Qutb and then later a bunch of inspired groups from Salah Syria's attempted coup to Shukr Mustafa's Gamat al-Muslimin, better known in the media as Takfir al-Hijra, to Muhammad Salam Abdul Farag's Tanzim al-Jihad and Gamat al-Islamiyya, let alone all of the key Egyptian figures at the founding of Al-Qaeda and later Ayman al-Zawahiri joining it, today Egypt is very much not the center of gravity for the jihadi world. Syria, of course, is. That said, there is still militancy, insurgency, and terrorism happening in Egypt, with a huge uptick since the coup in July 2013. To guide us through everything today, we have Mokhtar Awad on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So in your article from the August edition of the CTC Sentinel titled Buyer Remorse, We Lie at Sinai in the Nile Valley, you provide some background on the development of jihadism in the Sinai in the 2000s. Can you talk about that a little bit, as well as how some of these individuals and factions became plugged into the Gaza jihadi networks as well during that time?
Certainly. As you outlined, obviously, Egypt has always been looked at quite correctly as the home base where much of what we understand now to be Islamist militantism and Salafi jihadism developed. When jihadi activity or jihadi kind of ideas started to spread in the early 2000s in the Sinai, this, of course, came when there was a low-level insurgency that was waning in the mainland of Egypt. Now, initially, from what we understand, a major role was played by local Bedouins who had actually went to the mainland to study, obviously influenced by the happenings there, education, the type of education that they had, but also Islamist ideas were being imported into the peninsula with the teachers, other bureaucrats, government workers who were sent there. And of course, many of them were actually kind of sent there, not necessarily as a form of severe punishment, but it wasn't necessarily the best of posts. And so when we had the initial group at Tawhid al-Jihad forming up in the early 2000s, the major three leaders were indeed local Bedouins, but it wasn't necessarily their local context that sprung up the jihadi ideas that they were indoctrinated with, but again, rather the influence by mainland Egypt and what was happening there. Initially, the group, of course, became influenced also by the U.S. invasion of Iraq, but fundamentally, when you're based in the Sinai, there is a limit to what you can do in terms of being able to actually, you know, participate in some way with what's happening in Iraq or Afghanistan. You would need to send people there. So initially, of course, there was an idea of setting Sinai basically as a camp where you train people and that they can go and fight in Iraq and in Afghanistan. However, ultimately, the focus became on attacking Western interests in Egypt, and of course, in the same time, attacking Egyptian-Israeli relations and, to an extent, the Egyptian state, which was why in the period of from about 2004 to 2006, you had about three major attacks on tourists in South Sinai that were quite devastating and really quite effective in being able to show that even though jihadism was waning in the mainland of Egypt, something new was springing up in the Sinai. Now, it is important to kind of understand actually what happened between 06 and 2011 for us to be able to understand groups like Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, because even though in that period the security forces were able to gain an upper hand and clamp down on that initial group, it is within that period where you start to have really a lot of the grievances that we now understand to be one of the drivers develop, and also a period of rebirth. And so the first three leaders, as is highlighted in the article, were eventually killed. But in the process, we had thousands of Sinai citizens arrested, detained, hundreds, of course, if not thousands, tortured as well. And also, you had people fleeing, at least the most critical of these individuals, of course, understood the need for them to look elsewhere. So some allegedly had traveled to Gaza to try and escape the onslaught. And in that process, you begin to have, the process of kind of cross-pollinization between North Sinai-based militants or Sinai-based militants and Gazan-based Salafi jihadists. Of course, there's a historical connection, very obvious historical connection and tribal connection to some extent even between these two areas. But when the state starts to clamp down after 2006 or so is when you have more of a process of people establishing connections. Now, on the other end, as the state was gaining the upper hand in the Sinai, and again, you had people fleeing and you had thousands arrested, tortured, and so on, is Gaza itself was witnessing its own jihadi surge. The problem, of course, when you have a group like Hamas running the show, is that that kind of Muslim Brotherhood militancy does still not satisfy your Salafi jihadi. And of course, we all know the infamous incident was the Ibn Taymiyyah Mosque in Hamas, and a huge relative to, of course, Gaza's size and the size of the Salafi jihadi community there, exodus out of Gaza into the Sinai to try and escape the pressure. And here you have really the most important phase of that kind of cross-pollinization, of them sharing expertise, ideas, and beginning to think ahead of how Sinai can be used as a base of operations. So I'll end it here. But that gives you the brief, very brief history when we look into the Sinai and how we got from the early 2000s of indigenous militants who wanted to have a jihadi presence, carried out the attacks in South Sinai against tourists. The state clamps down, creating, environment of grievances, but also in the same time, Gaza experiencing its own jihadi resurgence, and them being able to influence and learn from each other. While this is all happening, there's a completely kind of alternate timeline, if you will, that at times crosses, intersects, and at times not. And that is, of course, of Al-Qaeda's interest in Egypt. As we know, of course, Ayman al-Zawahiri is an Egyptian. During the time of the early 2000s, the bulk of Egyptian jihadists were basically surrendering. We'd like to call it them, they're revisiting their ideas or recanting their views. But in reality, the majority were effectively surrendering to the Egyptian state that was able to ultimately gain the upper hand. And initially, Ayman al-Zawahiri, as I would like to think, of course, the evidence shows this, and the events I'm about to describe show this. But since he is an Egyptian, and I think since this is where it all started, this is something that even though we've seen Al-Qaeda has not necessarily been too successful at, has been on his mind. And so the initial attempt after the al-Jihad departure and, joining up with bin Laden and so on, was allegedly trying to resurrect something called Tala' al-Fatah, vanguards of the conquest that by 2002, the Egyptian authorities are able to also clamp down on and build a case to show that Ayman al-Zawahiri and others who would join what was then beginning to be called Al-Qaeda did in fact try to resurrect this clandestine cell to try and resurrect the dead jihad of the 1990s. We had a relative period of quiet between 02 until come 2006. A man who was a member of Jama'a Islamiyya, but not Islamic Jihad, joins with Al-Qaeda. Actually, it was a faction of Jama'a Islamiyya, joins with Al-Qaeda at the time. His last name is Al-Hakaymah, also known in Kenya as Abu Jihad. And he, in 2006, declares what they hope to be Qaeda al-Jihad fi Ard al-Kinana, Al-Qaeda in the land of the quiver, Al-Qaeda in Egypt. But this was mostly a remote exercise. Him in Pakistan, some allege Iran, online attempting to incite people to form clandestine cells, link up with Al-Qaeda, join Al-Qaeda. But he is killed 2 years later, and that process, that operation basically goes bust. And then, of course, we get to the revolution, and this is where we can have the second part of the conversation. But that was the Al-Qaeda track, if you will, up to 2011 and the attempts that they were making to try and regain a foothold in Egypt.
Yeah, so can you maybe walk us through what jihadi individuals and movements were doing in Egypt following the uprising in 2011 up through, say, maybe the coup in July 2013? It seemed that while, there were a bunch of attacks that were conducted over this time period, and some of these groups were securing weapons and training in the Sinai, a lot of the activity, at least in the Nile Valley, was mainly dawah and media work, especially for the individuals that left prison. Can you sort of look at this time period maybe?
Sure. And so, of course, come 2011 is really the golden age for jihadism in Egypt. Come the coup, it's the second golden age. And you have two processes happening in Egypt at the time, as you describe. People in the mainland who are mainly interested in trying to reform the fundamentals, if you will, that you would need to have in place for you to effect the Salafi change that you have in mind. Eventually, it involves violence, and so be it. These people mainly have to do this because the environment was not too hospitable for it, and the networks were, of course, greatly degraded. But, however, as I said, come the end of the 1990s, when you had the end of the so-called low-level insurgency, a lot of focus is, of course, on the so-called de-radicalization that happened. And sure enough, a lot of these people did abandon the most violent interpretations. But for most, this really was defeat. And so for some of these folks, they still held on to their belief. And so when it comes to 2011, it wasn't just the threat of the people who were let go of prison. So there was, of course, lots of prison breaks that happened early on, but there were pardons by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. And so a lot of people rightly focus on these individuals who escaped or were released from prison, who were trying to reestablish their networks. But at the same time, there were people who were not in prison, but were very much underground. And come 2011, they witnessed an opportunity. While that is happening in the mainland, in Sinai itself, as we've established, there is more of a Gaza-oriented Israel-oriented operation in place, where Sinai is looked at as a base of potential operations against Israel. We had, by that time we could still call Tawhid al-Jihad underground operating on some level, but people who are coming from Gaza, of course, at the time, as you know, Israel alleged that it was Hamas by some proxy was helping fund these folks. They are beginning to establish camps, ensure and procurement of more weapons, explosive capabilities to carry out what we saw in 2011 and 2012, about two major attacks against Israel or on the Egyptian-Israeli border, one in 2011, one in 2012, and other kind of smaller incidents that has happened. In that period, you have kind of an explosion of different groups, ranging from Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen to Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis. But at the time, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis wasn't necessarily the only group, obviously, or even the strongest group operating in Egypt or the Sinai Peninsula. And Ansar, as Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, however, was focused on things like blowing up the gas pipeline between Egypt and Israel, you had groups like Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen, which still, whatever vestiges remain of that organization to this day, are very much still committed to attacking Israel and see that the priority is attacking Israel. And so after 2011, you had people like Muhammad al-Zawahiri and Sheikh Ash'ush. These were, as you know, and some of the listeners might have heard their names before, were old jihadi leaders from the era of the 90s. And rightfully so, those who were in the mainland after 2011 that wanted to do something, they realized that they can't actually initiate and instigate that process in the mainland. And you had people like Ash'ush who actually go to Sinai many times and try to establish a presence there. The same goes allegedly for Muhammad al-Zawahiri. And we had al-Qaeda, because of this, able to have an entryway more into the Sinai. And initially, they had a group by the name of Ansar-e-Jihad, which was the first and technically only group that ever explicitly pledged allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, spring up in the Sinai Peninsula. And so the focus, of the people who did or were from in the mainland at the time was still to try and find a way to use Sinai as a launching pad for operations against Israel. However, though, at the same time, although al-Qaeda is focused, or at least from what we know, since one group at least had pledged allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, although they were focused on what was rightfully a really kind of prime real estate in the Sinai and being able to open that front against Israel, at the same time, what would become the dominant group, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, kind of has a chance encounter, although I don't know to what extent it was truly random or they were planning it. Some of the people who were in the mainland, right? So we said there were people in the mainland who were focused on da'wah, others who wanted to do something, and so then they moved to the Sinai to either join existing groups or form existing groups, more of the latter. You had also people who were interested of saying, well, what about doing something here? Going to the Sinai and staying there and fighting there wasn't necessarily their highest goal. Going to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan at the time, there was a building momentum for a Syrian jihad. Either they weren't interested in doing that or they just simply couldn't. And so you had some individuals who were interested in forming something in really the real target and the real prize, which is mainland Egypt. And that is what we started to have in 2011. That's what the paper tries to kind of offer into the debate and the scholarship on this, to show that as early as 2011, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis as one group amongst many in the Sinai, Salafi jihadi groups, begins to have contact with mainland-based operatives who are interested in forming clandestine cells with the primary goal of alleviating pressure on the Sinai, if need be, but also eventually to carry out operations. And so here again, we yet again have these two kind of parallel tracks. As Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis and the other groups in the Sinai begin to establish their presence more and more, and there's a period of mergers that eventually happen, and Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis comes out basically as a top group. At the same time, it is actually actively establishing a presence in the mainland, setting up cells in different provinces and different governorates, because they rightfully recognize that there is a reservoir of Egyptian mainland would-be jihadists who are interested in carrying out operations there. And sure enough, the reason why, so here now we've arrived at the coup. When the coup does happen, in the span of weeks, months, you are able to have spectacular attacks take place. One of the first, of course, was the attempted assassination attempt against the Minister of Interior. This came a few months after the coup. The reason why you're able to have such intelligence, people on the ground, operatives, hideout spots, and so on, is because since 2011, the branch of Ansar Beit al-Maqdis that is initially and has always been of indigenous mainland Egyptians has this infrastructure in place, and come the coup, come their calling, that they're finally able to act on what they initially wanted to do, and that is carry out operations in the mainland.
Yeah, so maybe you could give us a little more background about Jamaat Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, sort of where did it come from originally, who are the key players within it, and what it was basically up to between its founding and when it pledged bayat to the Islamic State and became Wilayat Sinai, or Sena, as they like to call it.
Sure. So, you know, as I alluded to, and it is, you know, I would have to commend the listener who's following along. Sinai at the time is a dizzying landscape and place to look at. Here, of course, I'm talking 2011. Initially, you have, again, a group like Ansar al-Jihad, which declares bay'ah to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda. You have groups that are more affiliated to Gaza, like Majlis Shura Mujahideen, which becomes a merger of two other groups in the Sinai. Ansar Beit al-Maqdis is really, in a way, the best way to kind of you know, describe it, is a continuation of the Tawheed wa Jihad kind of legacy. The two groups that I described, you had people who were interested in the Sinai, like Al-Qaeda, because of, you know, the fact that they want to expand and so on. And you had people who are interested in the Sinai solely to focus on Israel. But here you have a group of mainly indigenous Sinai Bedouins. It does include others, mainly from Sudan, some from Yemen, allegedly the Yemen part, but definitely from Sudan, that are actually more interested about, well, do we establish an Islamic emirate in the Sinai? And they begin to have more of a focus on consolidating their control in the Sinai proper. And over the course of late 2011, 2012, early 2013, many of the other groups, it kind of becomes a survival of the fittest, either wither away and die, or slowly merge, and Ansar Beit al-Maqdis absorbs them. The leader of Ansar Beit al-Maqdis before he dies, this is, of course, early on in 2011, is a man by the name of Tawfiq Farij. And Tawfiq Farij, you know, was someone, as well as some of the other people, come from the same tribe that the initial leaders of Tawheed al-Jihad were from. And so for that reason, I say, you know, the best way to kind of understand who Ansar Beit al-Maqdis are actually from in the midst, sorry, of this dizzying landscape, is that they're really the best, they were the best equipped and the most determined, but also demographically and objectives-wise, were closest to the makeup of the local Bedouin population and al-Tawheed al-Jihad. Come, you know, the coup, of course, the objectives of Ansar Beit al-Maqdis change rapidly. The Egyptian state, the Egyptian army, turn into being an enemy. No longer is the group just interested in somehow establishing an Islamic emirate in the Sinai, or occasionally engaging in attacks against Israel. Now the objectives are much more broader, and they're much more serious, taking on the Egyptian military in a systemic way to actively try to implement the Islamic emirate that they have in mind. And in a way, Ansar Beit al-Maqdis begins to transcend the fact that it is a local Sinai group. And so it comes to represent the Egyptian Jihadi group. And that's why we refer to it in the paper, Samuel and I, as really the people who are holding up the banner of jihad against the Egyptian state. And over the course of, let's say, fall of 2013, up until the summer of 2014, the group is able to show an incredible ability in activating the Nile Valley network that I had just talked about in the previous period, but also accelerate and be more aggressive in consolidating their control over the different and various groups, not only in the Sinai, but now also in places like Ismailia. There was a small group called the Furqan Brigade, so the Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis then utilizes to carry out an attack against the military intelligence building in Ismailia. And the group, in a way, kind of becomes bigger than what it's always meant to be. However, as it expands, of course, it exposes itself to far, far more risk. There's a lot more people joining the organization at the leadership level. You have people with different tendencies as well, again, because as we just established, lots of mergers begin to happen. And so come summer of 2014, and actually David Ross, he points to this rightfully in one of his pieces, you know, about the run-up to the Pledge of Allegiance to Daesh, Dawla al-Islamiyya, is the fact that a lot of its the Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis leaders got killed off, right? So because of this expansion, if you will, the fact that it's now the central group in the crosshairs, the Egyptian military is actually eventually, because of the brute force that it's using, scorched earth techniques. The thing about scorched earth techniques is that they don't work in the long term, but they actually do have results in the short term. And one of those results is that they were able to kill a lot of the leaders. And one of the more convincing theories up to the moment is that many of the individuals who would have been not necessarily pro al-Qaeda, but averse to joining a group like Dawla al-Islamiyya just because they don't want to make Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis into a transnational group and instead make it focus on the national objectives, were killed off and died off. And also at the same time, because of the group's weakness, it has more of an interest and a vulnerability to join ranks with a group like Islamic State. And of course, there's another component which adds yet another layer, but it's very important, is that while all of this is happening, all that was stuff that we just talked about, you have thousands. Now, this is a number from the Egyptian authorities. And of course, no one can know for a fact, but I believe the number is in the thousands, at least less than 3,000, of Egyptians who traveled to Syria to fight in the, you know, budding and at the time full-scale Syrian jihad. You have a good amount of these people also joining the Islamic State. And it comes to a point where there is a level of connection and back and forth where somebody I interviewed who had wanted to join Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, what they told me was they told him to go and find a brother in Syria to vouch for him to join. And so you start to have Egyptians who join IS proper, again, following a completely different track, who also begin to kind of not only exert influence, but they have a stake in hoping and in wanting to make Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis into an Islamic State affiliate and eventually Sinai into a so-called province. And so these different factors at play, and I think also, and also the most significant one is the fact that there was a high level of not just attrition, but if you look at the numbers, if you look at the data in a paper that was just published today by Carnegie that I put out, been working on over the last 2 years or so, looking at the death of the security service members from the coup up until today, you really have the period of least intensity in the late summer of 2014. And that again shows you how the security forces were gaining the upper hand. And so in a way, up until the acceptance, if you will, of pledging allegiance to ISIS, ABM was at its weakest point. And so for these different reasons, we have a group who started off as being hyper-local, very local, becomes national, avoids explicitly pledging allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda, transform into the most extreme example of jihadi transnationalism up to this point, and joins the Islamic State. But in the process, as our article argues, it inhibits it from being a national level actor. It is no longer the group that is taking on necessarily the Egyptian army to avenge the death of the Islamists in Rabaa, potentially being the spearhead of the Egyptian jihad and toppling the Egyptian government and all of these things. No, now it's the Sinai province, and its operations are going to be mainly in the Sinai province, and it's following the orders of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in Mosul or Raqqa, take your pick. And so that's kind of the trajectory of Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis from its founding evolution, 2012-2013, and up to the point of its pledge of allegiance to ISIS. And our thoughts, this is, of course, Sam Tadros I'm referring to for the Sentinel piece about the implications of that on such a group.
Yeah, and as you allude to, there were some changes. So can you talk a little bit about how ABM changed, especially militarily, after the announcement of Wilayat Sinai? And besides the military aspects, have you seen them take on the non-military aspects? We've seen some other of ISIS's other wilayat in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and elsewhere, in terms of Dawah, Hizbah, and sort of proto-governance activities in the Sinai at all?
Sure. This is an excellent and important question, because the interesting thing is, when you look at the data of the security services' death, you actually see a spike happening about a month before the bay'ah to ISIS. Of course, no one can know things 100%. I don't claim to be the primary and certainly the only reason, but I think it shows that in the lead up to the Pledge of Allegiance to ISIS, there was an injection of cash. It is alleged that some of the individuals that I referred to, who were Egyptians who joined IS, came back to join the ranks of the group, increase its fighting capacity and capabilities. And sure enough, come late September and early October, you begin to all of a sudden have IEDs that take out more than a dozen soldiers or about a dozen soldiers at one time. They're more frequent as compared to the previous months. And all the way up to late October, in Karam al-Qawadis attack, one of the first times, they're able to run over an entire checkpoint and kill about 30 or so soldiers. And so we've seen actually the impact of that happening even the month prior of the bay'ah, and we see an amazing increase in their capacity. They're also procuring more advanced weapons. Now, I can't say this is just because of their pledge of allegiance to ISIS or something else, and they may have used them on some occasion, but I don't personally know of a time where they've had such a stock of Conrad anti-tank missiles that, as you've seen, they've been using a lot more frequently, especially this year. And so definitely we see that, as part of its pledge of allegiance to IS, the ABM is a much more competent force, has more advanced weapons, and quite much more ambitious in the type of objectives it has, as we saw in the July 1st Sheikh Zawayid attack, where they were able to hold their ground in Sheikh Zawayid for about half a day, basically, against an Egyptian onslaught. It only ended with the intervention of F-16s. Now, when it comes to the issue of proto-governance, you definitely have them start to kind of pay more lip service to that and try to shine more of a light, on it. Although in the Sinai context, when you compare it to the other wilayats, you're always scanning and looking at, it's really pathetic in comparison. You know, I think one of the very first things that they did to kind of show them providing was handing out envelopes of cash. When they do hand out food or food supplies, it'll show you like a pickup truck with maybe less than 100 or so bags that they have to give out. And so the type of infrastructure, if you will, or lack thereof, that they have in place isn't really something that significant. Although, yes, since their pledge of allegiance to ISIS, they've attempted to kind of show that they're more active on that front. The other thing that they've done on a few occasions is trying to intercept a shipment of cigarettes or something and burn them. But again, when you actually look at the quantity, especially when you compare what they're doing there as opposed to the other wilayats, it's really quite small. And it just shows you how they go out of their way to try and give you the impression that they are, providing. But when it comes to the issue of Hizba, you know, and of course being the judges, if you will, the legislative the judicial kind of functions of Sinai, which I think are really the more important aspects of when we begin to kind of, if we have to put down on a table, what constitutes jihadi control other than the military visibility that they have or the claim they have. And I think, of course, obviously it's Hizba and, you know, the judicial kind of control. We don't actually see that in the Sinai. And this is important to point to because some people have been repeating, you know, that, ISIS or Wilayat Sinai controls a few villages in North Sinai. And this is a claim that's been repeated, a few times from last year. Some seem to believe this. They're present in a few villages, but that doesn't mean control. You know, the militants don't have teleportation technology. You know, they're going to carry out their attack and they come back somewhere. And that somewhere could be a village or a place where it may be a no-go to zone for the military because of high casualty rates. But they're hiding out there does not mean they control that area. They're able to actually establish Hizba in a systemic way that they are able to hoist their flags and establish basically a local imara. And the final thing, you know, more importantly, kind of when you try to measure Hizba and stuff like that, and to what degree of control they have, even if we want to compare, small scale implementation of Hizba compared to what IS does now in Iraq proper, if we want to compare what's happening in the Sinai to the Islamic State in Iraq days, where they were living in the shadows, yet still, trying to implement Hizba and quite successful at it in some areas. We don't even see that in the Sinai. If you go to Sheikh Zawayid today, I wouldn't necessarily advise that, but you will still be able to attend weddings that blast music and people dancing. And sometimes the typical things you see in Egyptian popular weddings, quote-unquote, spirits and drinks and so on. Now, that's not pervasive, but to give you an idea, again, people, even in Sheikh Zawayid, you can see them, if you go on social media and look at how the people actually live and what they post and things like that, there isn't a process where it seems that people would be scared, for instance, of holding their own weddings, blasting music, dancing, and so on, because of a Wilayat Sinai presence or fear of reprisal. So they're still working on that quite a lot, actually.
Yeah. So now turning a little bit to the West, more recently we've seen some stuff happening in the Western Desert. And what role would you say, if at all, IS's wilayat in Libya have played in what's been going on in the Western Desert of Egypt, and whether these provinces in Libya are related at all, or talking, or coordinating at all with Wilayat Sinai?
Sure. This is, yes, very, very important. I've been trying to gather basically all the facts that one can gather about this. But before I give the answer, of course, overall, you know, Egypt, it's a very complicated landscape with three major theaters and three different types of groups, but I won't go into the different groups. But the three theaters for our purposes, obviously the Sinai, the mainland, and the West. And the West hasn't really been an active theater up until late last year. Now, what we are seeing is more of a Islamic State militant presence that I think is very clearly people who are coming from Libya. That to me, I've heard and I also frankly just deduce as well from looking at where the different clashes with security forces have taken place and the types of activity that they're doing there. It's obvious that these are people who are coming over from the border. Now, the key question is, and unfortunately, this can only really be in the space of kind of speculative analysis because there's a limit to what we can know about the West, is whether, you know, the reason that we see, IS in Libya kind of, you know, poking its head in Egypt or at least making itself known is because they are trying to protect the very precious smuggling routes that are really at least the one that is cutting through Egypt from Libya is one of the major arteries in the region that keeps supplies going to in all sorts of directions. And that is because Egyptian security forces have been able to gain the upper hand in intercepting more and more of these routes. And so they're there to try and establish basically a level of protection for these smuggling routes. Or are they actually trying to implement establish a foothold there? That is still something that is not exactly clear. Now, the reason why it could be the former, that is protecting the routes and making sure the area remains an area of chaos and confusion, really the first time that we are told by Islamic State that they're operating there, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure, and what I'm about to say, was actually not that long ago. It was the same day the infamous Apache helicopter on Texan, Mexican tourists happened. And the nature of that operation was quite interesting because what IS was doing there, basically, and what they posted about, they kidnapped a local Bedouin in the Wahad al-Bahariya area, and they decapitated him. And that is, you know, basically that was a primary goal the first and last time they explicitly post something on it. And the reason why they would do that, and the reason why they did that, and I dug deeper and I found he was not the first Bedouin from the Western area to be killed by IS, is because these Bedouins work as trackers with the Egyptian military at intercepting smugglers. And so that's why I think there, you know, it could be really a function of them trying to make sure the routes continue. The other reason why is because it's difficult to actually kind of establish a sustainable foothold in the Western Desert. It is, yes, at the same time, it's a vast expanse and all these things, which makes it difficult for the military to find them. But logistically, it's difficult to kind of keep up. But we don't know. That may be one of their objectives. One of the reasons why they might be kind of incentivized to do this, in other words, to have a foothold in the Western Desert, is that if they're smart about it, they could have different warehouses, right, in the various oases that are in the Western Desert or other areas that basically no one comes close to, that can hold the supplies that are coming and destined for the Sinai and then be transported later on, but now more safely because they now have a more sophisticated logistical network. The other thing at play, if they could establish training camps as well, but more importantly, if they're just able to have hideout spots where from the Western Desert, wherever the area It's because it's huge. They could actually carry out attacks virtually anywhere along the Nile Valley, just because of how the geography works. And basically descend, if you will, from the into the valley, from wherever base of operation they choose to have. But that is a bit far-fetched, which is again why I think there it could be more of an easier explanation of them trying to protect their smuggling routes. But in any case, it's very worrying, and it shows you this is the first clear example, other than the smuggling, of us beginning to see how one branch, of course, outside Syria and Iraq and Lebanon area, where one branch is able to kind of militarily or logistically, militarily alleviate pressure, that's one, or logistically support another branch of IS in one country. And as you know, of course, you follow Libya closely, there isn't really much to stop IS in Libya from being able to take this seriously in terms of sending fighters, establishing kind of other smuggling routes for the IS wilayats in Egypt. Libya is, of course, a failed state, and the border is very difficult to monitor. And so they have the potential to leverage, if you will, their presence in Libya in a way where it helps them establish a foothold in the Western Desert region in Egypt and open a whole new front against the Egyptian military.
Yeah, definitely. To shift a little bit, not everything has been completely rosy for Wilayat Sinai or the Islamic State. This is obviously going to be the last question I have about one of its former members when it was still ABM, Hisham Ashmawi, who left the group and fled to Libya and then subsequently created Al Murabitoun. And then officially pledged bay'ah to al-Qaeda's Ayman al-Zawahiri. Can you talk a little bit about him and what he's been up to since his split? And do you see him and his group inserting themselves back into Egypt and competing with Wilayat Sinai? Or are they going to be more involved in sort of maybe the milieu in Libya for now?
Sure. So, you know, Ashmawi, it's best to put, you know, that's an excellent question. It's best to put Ashmawi also in the context of al-Qaeda competition, obviously, with IS in Egypt, but also the fact that there is diversity. So on Ashmawi himself, quickly, it shows you what the Sentinel paper was trying to put forward, that ABM was able to work with operatives who were in the mainland, and they weren't sending people from the Sinai. And so Ashmawi is one of those guys, mainland Egyptians. He happens to be a former officer, but like other mainland Egyptians who are interested in doing something, some have traveled abroad, some haven't abroad to fight in jihad overseas. And Ashmawi is able to link up with Ansar Bitwa Maqdis very early on, to try and put forward the idea of carrying out the assassination attempt on the Minister of Interior. And it was really kind of a sell of former officers, basically. I don't know if they had a name. I don't know if these guys were thinking of forming their own thing even then, that is in 2013 or even earlier, or it just happens by coincidence that Ansar Bitwa Maqdis is able to find four guys who happen to be former officers. But in any case, we see that the first operation that we know Ashmawi's kind of print is on is the assassination attempt against the former Minister of Interior, the suicide bomber is a former officer, and the three other operatives are Ashmawi and two other former military officers. Ashmawi, because he's a former special forces officer, of course, he got cut out from the military because of his views. He was more conservative and so on. When he did join Ansar Bitwa Maqdis, or I should say start working with them, since some people, because of the differences now that are close to Ansar Bitwa Maqdis, say, oh, well, he was never really a member. He was just a guy we were working with. In any case, what he was able to do is provide training to Ansar Beit al-Maqdis in camps in the Sinai, but also very early on, when it comes to, again, to that Western Desert connection, he was able to carry out what was at that time really the first successful an Egyptian military checkpoint, and that was in the Farafra area in the Western Desert. He knows the Western Desert area very closely. This is where he received a lot of his training, really generally all the deserts in Egypt. And so he was a very important asset for Ansar Beit al-Maqdis when it comes to training them. But the thing about training is, once you train people, well, you know, now they can do this. And Ansar Beit al-Maqdis was able to receive the support from IS proper. And so in a way, by the time the Pledge of Allegiance happens to IS, and Hisham Ashmawi, who is, again, from the mainland, felt closer to the Al-Qaeda way of things. In other words, really, that, you know, you need to have a more national objective, and it only becomes transnational if you're attacking America or Israel. But the IS model was never really that appealing, because it's a distraction, right, from attacking Israel and America. He, by that time, leaves, some say, and this is what I personally came across, after the Farafra attack is injured, he then goes into eastern Libya, to receive medical care, and he stays there. And this is where basically he builds his relationship in a stronger way with Al-Qaeda-based militants there. And that's why, you know, the him leaving on Ansar Beit al-Maqdis wasn't necessarily too much of a blow when it comes to their operational capacity and capability. Now on to his group. Al-Murabitun hasn't, of course, taken credit for any attack in Egypt. It's alleged that in one of the different incidents that happened in the Western Desert, where the army took out a convoy of cars that were streaming in from Libya, and actually a helicopter, by the way, was destroyed. The army says that this was a malfunction. In any case, it's alleged that he was at least involved with one of the different incidents that happened in the Western Desert. So if we take that at its face, it shows us that maybe he is interested in transferring over, if you will, to Egypt. But up to this point, if we take the Ministry of Interior in Egypt at its word, what he has been able to do is direct clandestine operations, so establishing smaller cells in the Egyptian mainland. The Minister of Interior actually blamed Al-Murabitun before the group was declared and anyone knew its name other than them, of the attempted suicide bombing in the Karnak Temple in Luxor. And still to this day, some suspect that he may have something to do with the Hisham Barakat assassination. This is the former general prosecutor of Egypt. And again, the reason why is because it's actually not the case that jihadist groups have to declare their responsibility for every single attack, as we may now see in Turkey. And so some suspect that this may be the case, that he is behind some of these operations that haven't been, no one took credit for. And that's part of the strategy. Now, the reasons why, I don't know. I'm not going to get into speculation now. But overall, though, what Ashmawi has been able to kind of put forward, Robert Toole, and behind them, Al-Qaeda, is basically a new vision to say that, yes, now we've seen that there is promise for jihad in Egypt. In the beginning of our conversation, I went into the detail of Ayman al-Zawahiri's various failed attempts to try and revive jihad in Egypt. And now you have, you know, this finally taken up, being taken up. And I don't think al-Zawahiri, considering all the stuff that's happened with al-Baghdadi and IS, is going to let Egypt be a free operating ground for Islamic State, especially after so many tries. And what the Murabitun is more or less focused on right now, and Ashmawi in his recordings, He put out two recordings thus far, the last one over 45 minutes, which is something really, is to try and really kind of frame the jihad. And when you do that, it's a process of not only incitement and trying to gain recruits and sympathizers, but to implicitly also, it's implicitly also try and aim to kind of detract away from IS and the IS model of basically, now you've become a walaya, and now, you know, we're doing this to establish the caliphate. The Al-Qaeda model is, well, no, this is your local jihad. You have a local objective to take out Sisi by name. So that's why, you know, Hisham Ashmawi names him and talks specifically about attacks in a systemic way against them in the mainland, not just the Sinai, which at the end of the day, as much as they want to do in the Sinai, you're not going to be toppling the government. At worst, you know, if the Sinai gets conquered, which happened, of course, by Israel, Sinai can basically evaporate and disappear off the face of the earth, and Egypt moves on. And so if you're going to topple the government, you have to do something in the mainland. And the other part of that framing the jihad, and this goes, of course, beyond the Egyptian case, is to what extent you are able to focus on Israel and the Palestinian case. And so before the, you know, intifada of the knives, or the proto-intifada of the knives we're witnessing now, Hisham Ashmawi has been fixated on Bayt al-Maqdis, you know, on Jerusalem, in the videos, the audio recordings. Of course, before him, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Only now IS, obviously, because of all the stuff that's happening, they, you know, came out and put something. Now, that has always been part of Zawahiri's strategy, is that instead of, you know, aimlessly, if you're in the Sinai, just taking out, you know, soldiers at checkpoints and all of that kind of stuff to degrade and then ultimately build your own state, well, you have Israel right there. And if you attack Israel and you're able to penetrate and keep going at them, you are going to win a level of support that IS simply cannot have right now in Egypt by getting people who are over the fence because they're not quite sure if you are genuine, if you have in mind what they want, if you don't have ulterior motives and agendas, that when you do attack Israel, that one common enemy that every Egyptian Islamist or non-Islamist is indoctrinated to hate, then you might actually win over more youth. And even though attacking Israel does not bring Sisi closer to collapse, attacking Israel is a much more important and productive and useful rallying cry than attacking checkpoints of 20-odd year-old soldiers in Rafah and Sheikh Zawait. And so this is where, you know, you put Ashmawi, and it's in part of this larger, I think, attempt by Al-Qaeda to establish a presence in Egypt and detract away from Wilayat Sinai and IS. The problem, as we mentioned many times now, Murabitun hasn't actually done much, neither claimed responsibility for much. And so it's something that we will continue to watch and see. I think we know, we should believe that the Zawahiri and Al-Qaeda would take Egypt seriously. In a way, Egypt is experiencing a moment that comes every few decades. And it's time to seize that opportunity in Egypt. And I think they will be focusing their efforts on, again, this recruitment of mainland youth and finally being able to establish some sort of clandestine presence in the mainland that can be more fixated on bringing down the government. And the bigger question, and a much more difficult exercise, would be establishing an alternative presence in the Sinai. Now, in that, they have been a little bit more pathetic than usual. They try to... there's a group called Jund al-Islam now, or Ansar al-Islam, that claims to be pro-Al-Qaeda, but really isn't really doing much. But the message is that Al-Qaeda is trying to send, is that they too have people in Sinai that support them. And that is also a theater that I think again, it's very difficult that they'll actually do something, but is also a theater, I think, that they're trying to establish a presence. And if they do, as I established, I think their focus would be on bringing the Sinai Jihad into a state where it was in 2012 and 2011, where it was more focused on Israel, to rally support for Al-Qaeda. And I think, actually, I'll have this as a last final thought. You know, if I'm thinking ahead decades, in the next few decades, you know, obviously attacking the West, and we talk a lot about that a lot, you know, the spectacular attack in the West that would rally support again around Al-Qaeda. But I think the most important thing is whether or not one of these groups is going to actually be able to open the long awaited and sought after front against Israel. If Al-Qaeda is able to do that, again, vis-a-vis Egypt and the Sinai, then I think that's one of its best hopes to try and kind of reclaim the mantle and send the message that IS, with this great caliphate, isn't anywhere closer to delivering on the what's really one of the core objectives of the jihadist movement. And that is, of course, the destruction of Israel and, you know, quote-unquote liberation of Jerusalem. And so that's why I think Egypt will be, and the Sinai will continue to be a place to watch in the coming years.
Yeah, we'll definitely see whether these aspirations will turn more into actions and whether they'll be able to put a foot forward in competition with IS beyond just video messages and rhetoric for now. But there are certainly a lot of complicated dynamics and relations within the jihadi milieu in Egypt these days. But thanks for parsing these out for us today, Mukhtar.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from October 14th through the 23rd.
During that time span, we saw 11 foreign fighters killed in Syria with various groups, while 10 foreign fighters were announced killed by the Islamic State in Iraq.
On October 14th, the Islamic State released its official calendar for the Islamic month of Muharram.
Also on the 14th, we lie at Nineveh of the Islamic State graduated its first class of special forces in Mosul, Iraq.
On October 18th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State provides measles vaccines in Al-Kairouan district.
Also on the 18th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State restores a nursery preparatory school in Tel Afar, Iraq.
On October 19th, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State shows off its horse stables.
On October 20th, Wilayat Khorasan of the Islamic State graduates its first military training camp in eastern Afghanistan.
On October 21st, Wilayat Kukuk of the Islamic State restores the hospital mosque in Al-Hawija, Iraq.
Also on the 21st, Wilayat Al-Anbar of the Islamic State shows off its molasses plant in Heat, Iraq.
On October 22nd, Wilayat Trablus of the Islamic State shows off its candy and pastry industry in Sirte, Libya. Thanks to Hakon Jar and the other patrons of the podcast for their support of the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can visit the Patreon link in the show notes and make a small donation, which will help cover the costs of time and equipment and hosting that it takes to produce the show. Also, we're going to start releasing some bonus content in the next couple days that will only be available to our Patreon supporters. If you have any feedback, you can email us podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. The show is available on Stitcher and iTunes, and if you get the podcast through one of those providers, please consider taking a moment to leave a rating and review, which will help more people find the program.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Mukhtar for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster Carl Moran for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly, and to Elsbeth Crothers for helping with background research on the primary source material. Until next time, I'm out.